People interested in true crime are always baffled by the why. Why would someone do these things? What path in life could possibly have led them to commit such atrocious acts? In this podcast, we aim to explore the upbringings and backgrounds of some of history's worst criminals, but with a twist. Because we want you to set aside what you already know about them, we won't use their names until the end of the show, so you can listen anew and hopefully get insight into the question that haunts us the most. Why did they do it? Join us as we explore The Catalyst. It was a horror scene not witnessed since the war that had ended more than 30 years before. Nearly 1,000 bodies lay scattered. Some had happily taken the poison mixed into the drink meant for children, while others balked at mass suicide and, instead, received a bullet in the back of the head. The prophet was the second from last to die. He took a bullet to the head as his own voice echoed out of the speaker system over the village he had forced his followers to carve out of the jungle. Before the drug-induced paranoia, the prophet had once envisioned a church where the people of Indiana could come together and work for a better world. But it all ended in the jungles of Guyana, surrounded by the speakers still projecting the prophet's voice through the trees. Some of you are surely high-fiving yourselves already because you know who the prophet is, but in truth, I doubt you know much more than his name. Let's test that theory. The prophet was born May 13, 1931 in eastern Indiana. His mother, Lynetta, didn't see her child as a new lease on life, a reason to live, but rather as yet another responsibility. His father, James, also saw the baby as another stressor, having a mental breakdown soon after the baby's birth. James required months of hospitalization in the nearby town of Oxford, Ohio, after which a doctor described him as nervous, emotional, and irritable. He would eventually be sent home. According to Jeff Gwynn in his book, The Prophet, James would require periodic visits for more treatments. Lynetta didn't help much on that front. She judged her husband as weak, having succumbed to his mental issues. Jeff Gwynn describes Lynn, Indiana, as a close-knit town where everyone knew everyone else's business, where no one locked their doors and everyone minded each other's children. Even so, one of the largest organizations in the town was the Ku Klux Klan. But unlike the American South, there weren't enough black people in Lynn for there to be much racial violence. Instead, the Klan focused on other issues like better public education and prohibition. By the time the prophet was old enough to attend Lynn's public schools, they had such a reputation for excellence that delegations from Canada, China, and other U.S. states visited the small town to observe their programs. The townspeople expected Lynetta and James to conform to the ways of the town, going out of their way to help the couple. They found work for James where they could, non-strenuous work that he would be able to do with his disability. But Lynetta rarely spoke to anyone, even while she was out shopping on a Saturday or attending the Wednesday night community movie. Many in Lynn felt that she was acting superior, snubbing her nose at those she believed to be inferior. She would later say she simply didn't have anything to talk to them about and saw nothing on which to build friendships. Forced, however, to spend time with her husband's family, she felt resentment building up within her. She would conjure fantasies where she could best her so-called enemies with her wit and courage. And who was her only audience for her outlandish fantasies? Why, that'd be her only son, the prophet. In the fall of 1936, the prophet was old enough to start first grade, which also meant that Lynetta had to find a job that satisfied an arrangement made with her father-in-law. She found a job at a glass factory, spending all of her off time raging at the indignity of having to work, while her husband sometimes spent his days at the local pool hall. The prophet tried to invite friends to his house, but most soon left, scared by the oppressive atmosphere. Rather than spending time at home, the prophet, unsurprisingly, spent most of his time roaming the streets of Lynn. This wasn't unusual in the early 1930s, when little boys would often run around sparingly supervised as they found stuff to do and fill their days. When school started, they were given their brown bag lunches and trusted to walk to and from school. According to Jeff Gwynn, parents didn't worry because the adults in the area worked together to keep a cooperative eye on the town's children. The prophet's first playmates were his cousins, with two sets of aunts and uncles living on the same street. But once he started first grade, he was forced to spend even more time outside, as Lynetta refused to allow him in their house until she came home from work. This overly harsh rule soon became known around town, and homes opened their doors to the little boy. Rather than going to his relatives' homes, he wandered the streets until the ladies of the town invited him into their homes for snacks and even full meals. He swore to each of them that their meals were the most delicious he had ever tasted, leading each lady to feel like she had created a bond with the little boy. This was particularly true for Myrtle Kennedy, the first lady of Lynn's Nazarene Church. Standing at 6'2", Myrtle took her faith very seriously and took every attempt to convert people to her faith. While often the zealot, she was also renowned for cooking and baking for the unhoused people who entered the town on the railroads during the Depression. When the prophet appeared on her doorstep, she sensed the potential for conversion. Before meeting Myrtle, he hadn't attended church. She served scripture along with slices of pie, and she was thrilled when he began quoting passages back to her. Soon he accompanied her to church each Sunday. Lynetta didn't care. It was less for her to worry about on Sundays. She was also okay when the prophet began to spend random nights with Myrtle and her family. Privately, he began to call Myrtle Mom. The prophet loved Sunday mornings and going to church. He had an amazing ability to remember everything he heard, especially passages from the scripture. After a few weeks, he could repeat long passages verbatim, causing Myrtle to believe she had truly saved his soul for Jesus. She was disappointed when he voiced his desire to explore other denominations in town. The prophet began attending revival meetings of other faiths that the town's churches hosted. He listened to the Methodist preacher, the Quakers, and the Disciples of Christ. He would join them all over the next few years, either swearing allegiance or being baptized in each one. The people of Lynn found that to be just as odd as his parents' behavior, but in a more positive way. "At least he was going to church," they whispered to each other. Now, one might expect Myrtle Kennedy to be crushed or even betrayed by the prophet when he began attending and being baptized in other churches. In the words of Jeff Gwynn, she had set him on the Nazarene path, and he had wandered off of it. Yet, he retained Myrtle's affection. She continued doting on the boy through his religious experimentation. Their relationship was so close that Max Knight, one of the prophet's childhood friends, believed Myrtle to be his grandmother. If Max knocked on the prophet's door and got no answer, he knew to cross the street and check the Kennedys. On one occasion, Myrtle told Max that the prophet was probably in the nearby woods. Max found his friend standing on a stump, his hand pressed to his heart, preaching. When Max made himself known, the prophet was startled and started to cry. Gwynn supposes that he felt he'd been caught in a deception. He had told Max and Max's father that he wanted to be a pilot when he grew up, but now he was caught preaching. Confused, Max told his friend, if he wanted to preach, do it. Over the next few months, he was found in the woods preaching a few times, but voiced his concern that others might make fun of him or tell him he couldn't do it. Max reassured his friend, telling him not to let other people stop him. Just be your own man. This combination of paranoia and anxiety erupted at other times in the prophet's life. He was given a lot of leeway because of his volatile mother and sick father, but some traits couldn't be ignored. While his friends and classmates enjoyed roughhousing, he would run away from any physical play. He was quick to cry. He also swore a lot, something he learned from his mother, telling his friends that he enjoyed how it made everyone uncomfortable. The Prophet always seemed to have candy bars, a prize treat for any kid during the Depression. They weren't paid for with any allowance, though. Instead, he stole the candy bars from stores, and the stores allowed it because they knew Lynetta would come by on Saturday and pay for whatever he had taken. Rather than punishing her son, Lynetta took pride in his urge to defy convention. His religious obsession made him stand out from the rest of the kids in the area. The other children dutifully followed their parents to church each Sunday, but the Prophet excitedly entered multiple houses of worship each week. Soon he began to say strange things while playing with the other children, which slowly caused his group of friends to winnow. In one instance, a group of children were playing in the loft over the Prophet's garage. The boys decided to use the rafters as balance beams. When it was the Prophet's turn, he was a few steps across when he got a strange look on his face and told the other boys that he couldn't move because the angel of death was holding on to him. All three boys balanced precariously until he told them the angel had let him go and he could move once again. On another night, the Prophet convinced his friends to break into a warehouse where a casket company stored their excess stock. Like everyone else in town, the warehouse never locked its doors, allowing the contingent of kids to break in. He told his friends they should climb into the caskets, lie there, and hopefully they would find out what it felt like to be dead. Some kids were too scared, while others just got bored and left. The Prophet went back night after night, looking for some glimpse of the afterlife. Combining his love of preaching with his fascination with the macabre, he soon began hosting funerals for animals around town. It didn't matter where the animals came from, roadkill, mice, or rats from traps, the occasional house pet, and any birds he could find. Burying the animals in boxes as small as a matchbox, he planned elaborate services, praying over the corpses with his friends as the mourners. He would give sermons on how God loved all of his creations equally, but soon his friends became bored and stopped attending. Undiscouraged, the Prophet turned to the younger children in town, who were flattered to have the attention of an older kid. But he had to scare them into staying when they realized he expected quiet reverence instead of noisy playtime. Of course, this only worked for so long. When he couldn't find an audience for his funerals, he would perform them by himself, even during recess at school. The Prophet was 10 when the United States entered the Second World War. While the town of Lynn bedecked every building with red, white, and blue, he was fascinated with the Nazi regime. Their straight lines of soldiers, goose-stepping, and Union mesmerized him. He studied Hitler, especially how the German leader stood in front of immense crowds for hours, keeping his listeners engaged the entire time. To him, he saw himself in the Führer, a poor boy who had risen to lead a nation that had taken over a continent. Unable to convince any of his friends to play Nazis, he instead bullied his younger cousins into a field and ordered them to goose step. Not getting exactly what he wanted, the Prophet got mad, hitting his cousins with a switch. His aunts were furious when their children came home bruised, and the Prophet lost his minions, but he didn't lose his interest in the Nazi party. At war's end, he was even impressed with Hitler's suicide, taking his own life rather than allowing himself to be captured. The Prophet's fascination with Hitler didn't dull his commitment to a religion. When Myrtle Kennedy and her husband vacationed in a nearby town in the summer of 1942, the Prophet went with them. The Kennedys rented part of a big house where the Prophet met 10-year-old Lester Wise, who became his best friend that summer. They both attended a Pentecostal church and went to Bible study 3 or 4 times a week. Wise thought there was something unusual about his new friend. During each Sunday service, the preacher asked congregation members to come forward and be saved. Now, according to Wise, you only got saved once. I mean, maybe you could go up again if you did something really bad, but the prophet went up to the front of the congregation every single Sunday, asking to be saved. By high school, the prophet was an outsider in Lynn. Rumors had started that his father was a drunkard, a rumor no one came forward to refute, as it was better to be known as a drunkard than mentally ill at the time. To continue to set himself apart, he started dressing differently. Instead of the work shirts and jeans that most teen boys wore to school, he wore Sunday clothes, white shirts, and nice slacks every day. He singled out Sarah Lou Harlan, who was considered to be the prettiest girl in school. Even though she had a boyfriend, the prophet stalked her, following her around school and, when the day was over, following her home. According to Gwen, the prophet believed that if he wanted her, he believed he should have her. Sarah Lou and her boyfriend disagreed, with the boyfriend telling the prophet to leave her alone. When that didn't do anything, they hoped her parents might be able to talk some sense into him. Instead, the prophet managed to charm her parents to the point where they encouraged her to dump her boyfriend for this nice boy instead. This didn't work, and eventually, the prophet lost interest and moved on, acting as if nothing had happened. Unusual for a teenage boy in the 1940s, the prophet seemed to take a genuine interest in the lives of the county's African-American population and condemned the poor treatment they got from whites. While still in high school, he often took the bus to the nearest city of Richmond and walked to the segregated part of town. He would find a place to stand and begin to preach. His sermons were about everyone being equal in God's eyes and how it was morally wrong to treat someone differently based on the color of their skin. In 1948, Lynetta and her son moved from Lynn to Richmond. James would survive in Lynn for another few years before dying in 1951 at the age of 63. A high school senior when they moved, the prophet made few friends, all of them members of the school's Christian Youth Fellowship. Over donuts, the club members would debate the best way to live righteous Christian lives. Lynette's salary wasn't enough to cover their new lives in Richmond, so the prophet began to skip classes. He got a job at Reed Memorial Hospital. Working as a night orderly, he had to deal with things like vomit and amputated limbs. His bosses at the hospital took note that he tackled the worst jobs with a smile and won over the crankiest of patients. According to Gwen, patients of every background and their families felt that the prophet understood what they were going through. He remembered every patient's name and the names of their family members. Because he was too young to be promoted to supervisor, his bosses instead made sure to assign him to doctors involved in the most critical forms of care. By graduation, his life's path was in question. He had always intended to be a preacher, but he'd proven to be gifted at medicine. In 1948, the prophet met Marceline Baldwin at the hospital while she was a senior nursing student. The prophet was only 17, 3.5 years younger than Marceline. Just as with Sarah Lou, he was suddenly everywhere she was, love-bombing her. She even joked later that she married him just to get rid of him. And he brought up marriage awfully quickly, after only a few months. He told Marceline that married life would be a grand adventure. She had spent her life very sheltered, with her mother refusing to even open their curtains for fear someone might look into their house. Why, it just so happened she had been longing for a grand adventure. Her parents and friends found the prophet to be crude and unwilling to learn more genteel manners. They weren't quite sure what Marceline saw in the guy until they learned that he planned on becoming a preacher. They knew Marceline would just love being a preacher's wife. In January of 1949, the prophet resigned from the hospital, and 6 months later, he and Marceline got married. Soon after the wedding, Marceline's mother made a racist comment. The prophet looked at his new wife and told her she would have to decide between him and her mother. While Marceline didn't go no contact with her mom, she did limit their interactions. And for the rest of their marriage, if Marceline's mother walked in the front door, the prophet walked out the back. A year into their marriage, the couple took in Marceline's cousin, a 9-year-old boy named Ronnie. Ronnie had been living with a foster family when Marceline and the prophet invited him to live with them. Soon, the three moved to Indianapolis so the prophet could take pre-law classes at the University of Indiana's campus. While in Indianapolis, the prophet's interest in socialism was renewed and reinvigorated. He attended every meeting he could find, bringing Marceline along. His enthusiasm often made attendees nervous, wondering if he was a government agent as he feverishly took notes. At the end of every meeting, he went to the front of the room to introduce himself and shake hands. His overall interest in religion had waned, but his worlds collided in 1952 when the Methodist Church adopted a new social creed. The church now supported the alleviation of poverty, free speech, prison reform, and racial integration. He believed that the Methodist Church wanted to put real socialism into practice and had finally come around to his beliefs.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
While in Indianapolis, the family attended many black churches. The prophet loved the energy and loved seeing people love the role church played in their lives. Marceline liked the music, and they made a lot of new friends. They soon invited their new friends to their home, asking them how discrimination and segregation impacted them in their everyday lives. In the summer of 1952, at the age of 21, the prophet landed his first official preaching job when he was hired as the student pastor for the Somerset Methodist Church. While at first he was thrilled, he found it stifling. Everything had to be approved by the head pastor, and he found the services frustrating as there was a strict order to worship. According to Gwyn, it was the opposite of what he had enjoyed about the black churches he attended with his family. Feeling suffocated at Somerset, the prophet spent his weeknights at revivals and prayer meetings. He paid close attention to what worked and what didn't, and he found healings especially fascinating. He started small, his first healing didn't go well, but he impressed audiences. With his impressive memory, combined with what Gwyn called his stealthy reconnaissance, he was able to convince the attendees that he had God-given powers to read minds and prophesize. As his success in the revival circuit grew, so did his frustration with his day job at Somerset Methodist. The congregation remained lily-white and entirely resistant to his message of integration. The prophet would say it was his attempts to integrate that eventually caused his dismissal from Somerset in early 1954, but former congregation members interviewed by the FBI accused the former student pastor of lying and stealing funds. After separating from Somerset Methodist, the prophet and Marceline began their own storefront church called Community Unity, with the help of Quaker Ron Haldeman. His target audience was Indianapolis's inner-city black population, but he had to figure out how to offer something that their churches didn't. He soon bragged to Haldeman that his church had 24 members, with more joining each week. Skeptical, Haldeman decided to see for himself. Rather than the typical Christian type of service, the prophet walked into the room and asked his congregation, "What's bothering you?" A woman complained of a problem with the electric company, and the prophet dictated a letter to Marceline, taking suggestions from the crowd on how to improve it. When the church gathered the following week, the woman excitedly told the congregation that their letter had done the trick and resolved her problem. The prophet proudly said to his flock that they get something when they come to his church. That was how his church would differ from their other churches. Even with his church growing each week, it wasn't yet paying any bills. Marceline had a full-time job, but her salary wasn't cutting it. So the prophet was also forced to get a regular job. Okay, it wasn't quite regular. He began selling spider monkeys that he imported from South America door-to-door for $29 each. In addition to being a monkey salesman, you can't make this stuff up, he took a stab at any part-time job that he could land. But his church remained his focus. He returned to the revival circuit to raise enough money to keep it going. Once he finally found his groove, his services were so popular that people were turned away from the prophet's tent. He and Marceline took in hundreds of dollars each night. As the church grew more popular, members of his congregation noticed slight differences in their leader. Their pastor had grown into a famous man and had less time to help them with their individual problems. He rarely asked for input on letters anymore. But they were proud that while people were turned away from his tents, they got to hear him every Sunday. The congregation continued to grow, predominantly among African Americans, but with a few white members joining throughout 1954. More than 100 worshipers were squeezed into a space meant for no more than 30. The prophet finally bought a building at 10th and Delaware in Indianapolis that could hold up to 700 parishioners. The building had the word temple already carved into the stone, so he changed its name to reflect his philosophy better. It was now the People's Temple. As Gwyn points out, there was no apostrophe in that people's, as that would indicate ownership, and one of the church's goals was to discourage materialism. The prophet started several community-centered programs. According to the Indianapolis Star, the People's Temple operated a free restaurant for unhoused people, feeding more than 100 each day at their location on North Delaware Street. Another article from the Star mentions a different program involving unhoused men. The temple's hope was that those fed in their restaurant would join a program to improve the properties of disabled and underprivileged people who made their needs known to the church. The prophet and Marceline also concentrated their efforts on city politics, with Marceline proving to be an asset as the daughter of a former city councilman. While many African Americans in Indianapolis were used to empty promises, when white officials came to the People's Temple, they tended to follow up on their promises. In Guinness's words, the prophet preached like a black man and got things done like a white man. Over the next 6 years, he and Marceline adopted three more children, Stephanie, Lou, and Susanna, while also having one biological child, Stefan. In 1961, they completed what they called their rainbow family by adopting a black infant that they named after the prophet. In the same year, he was named the director of the Indianapolis Human Relations Commission, surprising everyone when he introduced rapid and radical changes. He still maintained his church duties, often working into the wee hours of the morning to meet all of his obligations. He was high profile enough that surely he could have asked for help, but he refused to delegate any power to someone else. Anytime someone offered, paranoia reared its ugly head, causing him to believe they were trying to take everything away from him. By the end of 1961, the city was significantly more integrated than before the prophet began his campaign. And while some people pointed to his church as part of the catalyst for that change, the prophet only saw its failures. Some private businesses had integrated in terms of customers, but he wanted them to better integrate their workforce as well. During a lunch with his old school friend, Max Knight, the prophet surprised Max by admitting he wanted to move his ministry to where he felt he could do real work. To that end, he set his sights on California. Like most Americans in the early 1960s, The prophet and his family were worried about the possibility of nuclear war with the Soviet Union. An article in the January 1962 issue of Esquire, titled Nine Places to Hide, listed the nine places in the world that were safest in the event of a nuclear holocaust. According to the article, the safest place in the U.S. was Eureka, California, a landlocked city of nearly 30,000 people that sits 283 miles north of San Francisco. The prophet and Marceline first tested a site in Brazil, but they floundered there, as did their church back home. Returning to Indianapolis, he first had to reestablish himself with his congregation. Many had left, and they had to downsize to a smaller building. He eventually returned to the revival circuit to recruit new members. Once he felt ready, he sent scouts ahead, with one settling in Ukiah, about halfway between Eureka and San Francisco, and outside the fallout zone. It looked like the perfect spot for his congregation. Now he just had to convince everyone to follow him from Indianapolis to their new home. The members who were left were die-hard believers in the prophet, and many had a personal connection to him. He drew on those connections to manipulate them, most of them older black women, to follow him to California. He told them that it was time to give back to him for everything he had done for them. If that didn't work, he figured out what would entice them more: California's warm weather, or its progressive politics. The final Indiana service of the People's Temple was in the early summer of 1965, with roughly 90 members of the congregation agreeing to follow him to Ukiah. But things there were much different than they expected. Ukiah wasn't a small-sized city like Eureka. It was a small town. When the predominantly black caravan arrived, the white residents didn't want them there. The tactics the prophet had used in Indianapolis didn't work to woo the local leaders of the small town, and he couldn't seem to ingratiate himself with the locals. While they weren't able to connect to the outside community, the prophet's control over his flock grew stronger. As they became more isolated, he told his followers who they could and could not marry, and with whom they could have sex. Many of the women in the group were forced to have abortions at the prophet's direction. Ukiah allowed them isolation and protection from nuclear fallout, but the prophet became convinced he had to move his congregation to San Francisco. He returned to the revival circuit, this time on the West Coast, to find more followers. In one event in 1970, he claimed to heal a man of his cancer and recruited 200 new members that night. By 1973, the People's Temple boasted more than 2,500 members. The prophet was becoming a name in Bay Area politics, even meeting with national politicians like Walter Mondale and Rosalynn Carter on multiple occasions. But not all was well behind the scenes. Several investigations had been opened against him and against the People's Temple. Many looked to debunk his miraculous healings, while many others wanted to expose the abuse that was rapidly becoming normal within the community. As if that weren't bad enough, the prophet began to use drugs while in California, which only heightened his mood swings and paranoia. Convinced he was losing control of his congregation, he prepared to escape the mounting threats altogether. By December 1974, the first congregants arrived in British Guyana to begin their new settlement, far from the prying eyes of the United States government. The entire group arrived in teams, each tasked with clearing the jungle, building houses, and everything else needed to prepare the property for long-term settlement. The majority of his followers had arrived in the South American country by the fall of 1977. While the point of moving to Guyana was to escape the possibility of government raids, the prophet was increasingly paranoid that raids were coming nonetheless. His drug use heightened his concern, causing him to prepare his flock for the worst-case scenario. Calling his followers white knights, he set out to prepare them all to die, either by outside forces or by their own hand. Loudspeakers were placed around the camp, and the prophet's sermons were played on a constant loop that everyone had to listen to all day long. The prophet hoped to create a group that would die for him. Between his drug use and his heavy workload, his health suffered. A year into the settlement, he began having heart problems and was confined to his tent. But when he learned that a U.S. congressman was coming with U.S. TV reporters, he knew he couldn't risk staying in bed. He hosted Congressman Leo Ryan, a Democrat from California, and allowed him to return to the nearby airfield to fly home. But before the plane could take off, the Prophet's Red Brigade of fighters rushed the airfield. They killed Ryan and four others, including an NBC cameraman, though not before he was able to capture footage of the attack. When he received word that not everyone had been killed at the airstrip, the Prophet knew time was limited. He told his congregation it was time to die by what he called revolutionary suicide. True believers had already mixed poison into a vat of Flavor Aid, not Kool-Aid, as has sometimes been misreported. After the prophet gave them a nod, the adherents began to hand out cups with a poisoned, grape-flavored drink to all residents. For those who refused to drink, they were injected with cyanide that the prophet had been hoarding for 2 years. 909 people died that day in the jungle of Guyana, 276 of them children. 85 community members managed to survive, with some fleeing into the jungle when the ritual started, while others found makeshift hiding spots. Who is this man who led his congregation from fighting for civil rights in Indianapolis to dying in a ritual suicide act in Guyana? James Jim Warren Jones died along with his followers on November 18, 1978. After the mass murder-suicide of Jonestown, the FBI opened an investigation not just into Jones, but also on why authorities, especially the State Department of the United States, hadn't done anything to investigate the long-standing reports of abuse. Jim and Marceline's bodies were found among the dead at Jonestown. His body was cremated, and the ashes were scattered in the Atlantic Ocean. To research this episode, historian Jen Erdman relied largely on the book The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and People's Temple by Jeff Quinn. Also used were The Untold Story of Reverend Jim Jones and His People by Tom Reiterman and John Jacobs, and articles from Esquire and the Indianapolis Star. The Catalyst is a production of Grab Bag Collab, created and engineered by Amanda Rossman and narrated and edited by Amber Hunt. You can support us and our other programs at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. That's GRABBAGCOLLAB. Special thanks to Daisy Egan for being our first pass editor and a collaborator on Grab Bag. Music comes from Soundstripe Inc., my dad, Bruce Hunt, and my son, Hunt Van Benskoden.